Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is the award-winning paleo artist John Gerchy. Gerchy is artist in residence at Ithaca's Museum of the Earth. His works have appeared frequently in National Geographic and Discover magazines, as well as in major natural history museums, including the Smithsonian, the American Museum of Natural History, and the Field Museum. He started out producing dinosaur paintings and was a consultant on the movie Jurassic Park. Last fall, Gerchy published an amazing new book called Shaping Humanity: How Science, Art, and Imagination Help Us Understand Our Origins. It's the account of his 15 sculptures created for the Smithsonian Institution's Hall of Human Origins, which opened in 2010. Shaping Humanity was published by Yale University Press. And welcome to the show, John.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be on again.
Now, your book, Shaping Humanity, is about the 15 sculptures you created for the Smithsonian's Hall of Human Origins. What was the philosophy around this, and why just 15 figures to portray 6 million years of human life?
Let me take that last question first. The 15 figures is because if it were much longer than that, I'd still be doing it. You know, that was really all there was time for, and there was barely time for that. I had to work a lot of overtime during that three-year period. It was more like 4.5 years crammed into 3 years.
Wow.
And the idea behind what we were trying to do with the 15 sculptures, six of them are bronze figures. One is a realistic silicone whole body figure, and then there are 8 head reconstructions. And what we wanted to do with all of that was to reflect the sort of adaptive story of each of those ancestors. And what I mean by that is the fossil record has shown pretty clearly that human evolution is not just a matter of all the things we think of as humans sort of slowly evolving in tandem with each other and arriving at today. It's much more of a mosaic pattern where some things happen early, some things happen really late. So that means that if you line up all the ancestors or candidates for ancestors among the fossils, then each one of them is going to have their own part of the human picture that they're adding to that picture. So, for example, if it's an early ancestor, the issues will be about becoming bipedal, walking on two legs for the first time. And if it's an early member of our genus, it'll be more about brain expansion and early tool making and that sort of thing. So really, each ancestor has their own adaptive tale to tell. It's almost like a Russian novel in that way.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
All these characters. So we wanted to reflect that particular story and what they added to the human puzzle, what their piece was in the poses. So that's especially possible to do when you're doing whole figures instead of expressions. We did it somewhat with expressions also, but could do a lot more with the whole figures. And so you have the Homo erectus figure is a female that's carrying a carcass, a gutted and skinned carcass on her back. And if that sounds grotesque, in bronze, it's beautiful.
It is. I've seen the photographs. All these I find beautiful.
Well, thanks.
Really beautiful. Yep. And you literally begin by looking at piles of bones, because all these discoveries aren't complete, right? So you say bones are not static things. Tell us what your relationship is to these and how you actually shape expressions from them.
Sure. Well, each reconstruction, of course, starts with the bones. It starts with what we know of that creature, and that's always fossil bones is pretty much the only source, except for the later ones where we're beginning now to look at Neanderthal DNA and that sort of thing. But usually all the bones are all we have to work with. But a skeleton is actually quite informative if you've done your anatomical homework. And as you said, bone is a dynamic system. It's not static, and it responds to forces that act on it. So, for example, if during an individual's life that individual has carried heavy loads all of his life, that's going to show up in some of the long bones that carry the weight. And you're going to see a thickening of the cortex. You're going to see that's basically the outer rind of the bone, let's say. And then you're also going to see muscle markings where the muscles attached to the bones. Those are going to be more strongly marked if they've been using that muscle a lot or if it's very powerful. So those markings tell you exactly where the muscles attached and give you some information about how developed they were. So it allows you to build a body.
Wow, that's amazing to me. That's amazing that you can just take bones and intimate all this stuff. But you've done a lot of work dissecting.
That's right.
And so that's how you found out about all this stuff and found the intricacies and was able to create real-looking ancestors, I must say. They're amazingly real-looking to me.
Thank you.
Now, I want to quote something that you say. The origin story revealed so far is fantastic beyond the power of mere human imagination. It is the story of a small corner of the universe becoming aware.
Yes.
And I absolutely love that quote.
Well, great.
Talk to us about what that awareness means. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's something that we're so close to that it's hard to really see it. It's hard to stand back from it far enough to see it. But when you think about what human consciousness or awareness is, it's something we use every day and take for granted. But when you think of something starting from basically inanimate matter and then ending up being aware as we are, that's really just it's hard to even get your head around how...
I know, it's an amazing leap.
Yeah, it is. And it's, I don't think anything that mere human imaginations have cooked up in terms of origin stories for various cultures or in terms of science fiction tales, I don't think any of that is as fantastic as our actual story.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? You're convinced of that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, that's true partly because we're, as you say, a portion of the universe become aware, but also because we're linked in ways that no other organism is. And we have this sort of linkage between nervous systems, really. You could look at humanity as a colony of nervous systems that are interconnected. We all share a matrix of language and culture that connect us. And language, I think, is really nothing short of a sound-mediated form of telepathy. You know, I can encode something in sound that I'm thinking of, something very specific, a raspberry ice cream cone, let's say, and I can make you think about it a second later.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that kind of linkage between individuals is pretty much unprecedented.
Yeah, it does feel like magic, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, you know, we don't have time to talk about all 15 of the sculptures, but that first one, the 6 to 7 million... year-old one in the collection in the book.
Right.
It looks like an ape to me.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the different attributes that you have found to say that this isn't an ape?
Right.
This really is one of our relatives.
Yeah, well, I'm not actually the one saying. I should make that clear.
Okay.
But and there is debate about it among anthropologists.
Absolutely,
But there, you know, the further back you go, if you think about it, the further back you trace our ancestry back toward the common ancestor of chimpanzees. If you were to do the same on the chimpanzee line, trace it further and further back, those ancestors would look more and more alike the closer you got to the common ancestor.
Mm.
So we're not talking about something that lived very long after that split. So you're going to definitely get something that looks very ape-like in lots of ways. But the things that have been pointed to that make this one special and not just another ape from that time period, which is called the Miocene, are two things, really. And they are an indication that this was perhaps an upright creature, and that what you find as evidence for that in this 6 to 7 million-year-old skull is that the hole where the spinal cord emerges is on the bottom of the skull instead of at the back of the skull. And that suggests it was held on a vertical neck. If you look at a gorilla or a chimpanzee skull, they have that hole way toward the back because they have necks that are almost horizontal there much of the time, or at least at a heavy-duty angle. It's not a vertical neck. So that's the first one that caught the eye of the discoverers of this thing. And by the way, it was found in Chad in Central Africa. And the other thing is that it has very small canine teeth. For an ape, would be large for us because we have teeny canines. But I should say for a male ape, and that's part of the argument, is this a male we're dealing with? The discoverers argue that it is. It has pretty massive brow ridges, and those tend to be bigger in male apes than female apes. But it's close enough that they're not certain it's a male. And if it's not a male, then those canines wouldn't be too unusual for a female ape. So that's part of what you're seeing there. If it's a male, it does look like the canines are reduced. And that's a very unusual thing for a male primate, but all the hominids do it.
Wow.
So
I know when I first looked at that first picture, I thought, now, what are the differences?
Right.
What makes us believe that, that this is really part of the human family? Tell us how you begin these sculptures. You say that you try to make us see that there's somebody home when,
right.
when you do the expressions and create these. Tell us how you begin.
Well, really, with a cast of the skull for a head reconstruction, or with the whole skeleton. If it's a whole body I'm building, then I make a metal armature at the center of it, and then I build a whole skeleton onto that. That's sort of act one of the process, and then I go on and add musculature and so forth. But all the while I'm thinking about keeping it consistent with the kind of pose or expression that we have decided on. There's a lot of talk among the team about what should the pose be, what should it be reflecting.
And you do sketches before you start doing the sculptures.
I do a lot of sketches,
most of the time, right?
Yeah, and I built, I built little matchstick models of the skeletons as kind of a secondary step after the sketches, just to show them what I was seeing. Once those were okayed, I built the skeleton. I was sending photographs to the Smithsonian all the time I'm doing this, so they could check it and stop me at any point if there was something they wanted to change, which did happen.
Oh, I'm sure. But I'm absolutely amazed at how you can, we do feel a soul coming from almost
right.
all these sculptures that you create. Where does that come from? Does it come from you as the artist or you as the scientist? Or?
Yeah. It's a little hard to say because part of this process involves fooling yourself to some extent, you know? I know when I'm building this thing that it's a thing of clay and plaster and plastic, and yet I try so hard to get a soul into the eyes especially that I find myself working late at night and working on my notes or whatever and looking up to find this thing watching me.
Uh-huh.
You know, just it just, you know, hits me with that impression that it's actually, you know, watching. And rationally, I know what it really is because I'm the one who put it there. But I'm also trying to make it so realistic that it will fool even me at odd moments like that. So it's. I think it's like being a fiction writer. If you're writing fiction, the first person you have to fool is yourself.
But, you know, like you said before, there's all this disagreement among people who are working on these subjects about these people. And so do you have to worry that you're making them look too intelligent, for instance?
Well, I suppose I could worry about that, but I don't.
But is that part of some of the disagreement, how smart it should look, how aware it should look?
I would say not. Most scientists tend to restrict themselves to the evidence a little more closely than that. And I try to, you know, for example, when you look into a chimpanzee's eyes, there's definitely someone home.
Oh, absolutely. I've seen them in zoos and stuff.
You get a strong feeling if you can get up close to one especially. And so I try to go for that level of awareness sort of early on in the lineup. But as I get later, it becomes more human. But that's such a subjective thing. I think most scientists are really reluctant to even comment on that. They're busy arguing about other things.
What kind of materials do you use? Do you use silicone and you build your own eyes, right? You create your own eyes. Tell us what kind of materials.
Sure. Well, generally I build the muscles in clay over a cast of the skull, and that can be either plastic or plaster. And making the eyes is a really intense part of the process because it's about a 35-stage process, and each step of it has to be seamlessly fused onto the last step. I think I'm at a success rate of only about 50% of eyes that work well enough they can be included in a reconstruction. So, and I take on those headaches because that's building a soul into them, and building a depth into the eyes is so important to what I do that if you don't do that, and if you come up with something that looks a little dead at the end of this process, you've really just got sort of an anatomical model and not much else.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, the pictures I've seen of these sculptures, they look totally real to me. I couldn't believe it.
Great.
I was thinking, how did he do this? I mean, the skin looks real.
Yeah.
Everything about it looks real.
For that, I use silicone. That's a fantastic material to work from because you can control almost every aspect of it. You can control the color, the translucence, the luster of it, So you can really make it look like skin if you carefully mimic those qualities that skin has. And it's a great material for that. I didn't start out using that material, and that was a mistake. When I put together the method for doing this, I wasn't trying to imitate anything I'd seen out there because I hadn't seen any really hyper-real human ancestors out there in museums before. So I was kind of making up my own method. And I consulted a lot with model makers and also Hollywood people, special effects makeup people. One of the people I talked to a lot was Dick Smith, who used to be the sort of go-to guy for old age makeup, but he did all sorts of other things too. But anyway, I reached a fork in the road where I could either go with silicone or urethane. I went with urethane, and years later, my sculptures started melting.
If you're just joining us, my guest is paleo artist John Gerchy. We're talking about his book, Shaping Humanity, How Science, Art, and Imagination Help Us Understand Our Origins. Now, I want to quote you. You said, something that happens between sculptor and sculpture that might be called animalistic magic.
Animistic, yeah.
Talk to us more about that.
It feels like you're
haunted by this stuff.
Yeah, you have to be, I mean, hopefully it's haunted in a pleasant way, but haunted, definitely. Yeah, I think that's more a further comment on how the sculptor has to begin to have a relationship that this is something alive that he's working on. And, you know, it's pulling the wool over your own eyes in a way because you're not concentrating on the fact that it's really just clay and plaster and so forth. You're really starting to have this kind of, I say animistic magic because that's a term used for religions where everything, rocks and trees and so forth, are alive and aware. And it's similar to that. You really have to start feeling that sort of magic is there. If you don't, if you go through the process and you don't feel that, I think probably you're on the wrong path somehow.
Yeah. Well, you said in your book that if it doesn't kind of freak people out or spook
them, then
you're probably not doing the right thing.
Yeah, I have people
react. Or creep them out. You said creep people out.
Yeah. And I've had people react like that, and I'm happy when they do.
Well, when I was looking through the book, I was thinking, my God, I can't believe these. This is haunting to me. And you know, I want to bring up Neanderthal because people are so fascinated by it, and there's so much myth.
Right.
And your portrayal of this Neanderthal is a very handsome guy, I think.
Oh, good.
But this coincided with the human race, right? I mean,
right. As
we know it now.
Yeah, that's right.
So talk to us about it.
Neanderthals have been around only a little longer than we have. And we've actually been on Earth a shorter amount of time than their tenure here on Earth.
And hint, they were extinct at some point.
Yeah.
Right?
Right. Yeah. So hopefully it's a morality tale, among other things, for us.
Did you have to get rid of all the myths and all the crazy Hollywood portrayals in order to really look into the Neanderthal and how to portray it?
Yeah, I did have to do that, and especially with Neanderthals, because there's such a lot of bogus information about
the caveman myth.
Yes, that's right. The caveman myth actually came about. It came from several studies that were done between, I think it's 1911 and 1913, on available Neanderthals at the time. And these are studies that established for the first time, you know, other people had suggested that these individuals were pathological in some way. This group of studies confirmed for the first time that these were actually a population. This was normal anatomy for their population. And there was a population of people that actually looked like this at one time. Now, the ironic part of that story is that what he didn't realize was the degree to which the skeleton he was basing most of this on was actually pathological.
Yeah.
So he came up with the sort of bent-hipped, slouching Neanderthal with the head thrown forward and all that.
And so it was arthritis, a lot of it, right?
A lot of it was arthritis. There are some misinterpretations of anatomy in there also that helped him arrive at that picture. But the whole thing was really, you know, it arrived at this myth of Neanderthals as a sort of slouching, primitive knuckle.
Oh, and it's the way we put each other down, right? He's a Neanderthal.
Right.
Get him out of here like a dumb person.
As Ted Kennedy characterized some of George Bush's nominations for the Supreme Court.
Neanderthal.
Yeah.
Neanderthals.
But they were actually as upright as we are. They had bigger brains on the average than we do.
That interested me.
Yeah.
You mentioned that in the book.
Right.
But how does that translate? I mean,
Yeah.
The bigger brains didn't translate into more skills.
I think once you take body size into account, they had a little bit bigger bodies also, then it comes out to be the same pretty much. And so nobody's sort of thrown by that because the relative brain size is as important as the absolute. So there's no evidence that I know of for behavioral capabilities or cognitive capabilities that are beyond human among Neanderthals.
You know what I've been wanting to ask, too? That brow ridge that we see on early humans. Well, what was that for?
Right. The thinking on that has been for a long time that it was sort of a shock, or at least this is one idea, sort of a shock absorber for the face. The idea is that human ancestors that used their front teeth a lot in gripping and pulling and stripping branches or whatever, you know, that gorillas do that. Mm-hmm. They pull a small branch through their teeth and strip the leaves. Anything that's loading the front teeth with forces like that. That force is supposed to be transmitted through the face and into the brow ridge. And that's one of the ideas that's taken hold as far as what that was all about.
And so as we evolved, we didn't need it anymore, right? A lot of people are still chewing on branches and stuff.
Yeah, well, I don't think we load our front teeth the way, for example, Neanderthals did. I mean, some of us do. Inuit people's process skins with their front teeth. So there's some of that going on. But I think you could argue that Neanderthals were using their teeth as a clamp a lot more than we were, than we have. And we tend to have delicate skeletons and bodies compared with all of the human ancestors. And that's probably because we use culture for so many of the problems that they solve physically. You know, if a Neanderthal has just hunted a woolly rhino, perhaps it throws the leg or as much of the meat as it can get onto its back and carries it home. Mm-hmm. Humans would invent a travois or a backpack or, you know, something with wheels.
We have our little SUVs to put on.
Right.
I want to talk about the fact that in 2009, right before this Smithsonian Hall opened, you were diagnosed with brain tumor.
Right.
Can you talk to us a little bit about how that affected you as an artist and as a person?
Sure. I think that experience, well, I should just say I was diagnosed with a malignant brain tumor in November of 2009. This is about 4 months before the Hall opened. So we immediately started looking for surgeons and actually found one really brilliant guy at Hopkins that we liked a lot, my wife and I. And so I had brain surgery in December, and I was very lucky to catch the whole thing at sort of an early stage because it was in a place in my brain that would have affected coordination and balance and basic faculties that I use in making art. So mm-hmm. I would have been really incapacitated if that was allowed to go forward. Anyway, I was lucky to get by with no symptoms at all, and I had the surgery. It was very successful. Had radiation treatments after that. The whole time this was going on, I kept working. And, I mean, there was one thing to be finished. It was the Lucy figure for the Hall. But I wasn't putting pressure on myself to get that done because I was way beyond any sort of consideration of, like, pouring on the steam at the end of a project. I was feeling much too flattened for that, especially during radiation. But every day, it just helped to have something to do, to kind of put one foot forward and in front of another. So the way it really affected my perspective, I think, is it allowed me to see my short little life, whatever finite stretch of whatever my lifespan turns out to be, in a context of a much larger time flow. And somehow it allowed me to kind of step back from that and look at it that way, and it made my life somehow seem more integrated with the whole big evolutionary stream that I had been wading in for 4 years pretty intensively.
Uh-huh.
I think when you feel a strong connection to human ancestors and through them to the whole tree of life here on Earth, that's a very life-enriching thing.
Mm.
And so that was kind of the perspective, or one of them, that experience engendered.
Yeah. So in some ways it illuminated the work you've always been doing, right?
Yeah.
Because you've always had that in your life, that whole trajectory
of
human existence.
This was more than I was usually able to do that. So it was quite a profound effect.
Oh, we're so glad that it turned out okay.
Well, thank you.
Now, at the end of your book, you talk about two scenarios that might happen in regard to the future of mankind. And then you have this beautiful quote that I want to read. It says, "We have the dust of yesterday sifting through our fingers and the light of the cosmos in our eyes. Will we trip ourselves up on our way to the stars?" Yeah. I think that's so beautiful.
Well, thank you.
And what do you think is going to happen in the future?
Well, the first thing to say maybe is that the fate of all hominid species so far has been extinction, except for us. And we tend to pat ourselves on the back and think it's something to do with our cultural superiority. It may have a little to do that with that, but it's important to remember that we've been on Earth for only 200,000 years, and that's shorter than almost all of the other hominid species that have existed. I think extinction looks pretty likely for us, and I think it's certainly the way that we're quickly destroying habitats and compromising environments as if there's no tomorrow, so to speak.
Yeah, trying really to create a no tomorrow.
Yeah, it doesn't bode too well for the future of humanity. In some ways, the way we behave currently is very much like a weed species. And what I mean by that is that there are species of plants that are not in it for the long haul. They move into an area that's been cleared by some natural disaster, let's say, or fire, and they use up resources quickly, reproduce, and move on to the next disturbed area. Meanwhile, there are much slower practices going on for other plants, like late succession trees in forests that are really in it for the long haul. And that's we need to switch from the one set of practices where we use up our resources. There's no place to move on to. Mm-hmm. There's no new home we can, as a weed species, we can colonize.
There's no habitat that we can run to.
So we need to sort of develop practices that are, as everybody talks about, sustainable. And we're not very close to that today. And I think it probably means that if there are aliens out there watching us develop, And they're taking bets on whether we survive or not, I'm thinking most are betting against it. If we get through our technological adolescence, where we actually can live in a sustainable way with our technology, then maybe we have a good shot at something really fantastic beyond what we are today.
Do you have any contact information that people can get in touch with you?
My website is pretty easy to. You just Google my last name, Gurchie, and it's the first thing that'll come up.
And you better spell that. www.gurchie.com. Well, John Gurchie, we're almost out of time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Sure.
And again, his book is called Shaping Humanity: How Science, Art, and Imagination Help Us Understand Our Origins. John Gurchie, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me on. It was fun.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.